Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on June 23rd, 2015, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Film Forum. My name is Mike Maggiore. I'm programmer of the premieres here, and Bruce Goldstein, our director of repertory programming, asked me to introduce our guest tonight. Just out of curiosity, who in the theater has seen Goodfellas before? Now, keep your hands up if you've seen it more than twice. That's very... Now, and you can put your hands down. Who has never seen this film in a theater or at all? Oh, that's pretty good. This is a film that really, you'll find, earns and rewards multiple viewings, and it's really a treat to see it in this beautiful 4K restoration. This is 2015 is the 25th anniversary of the release of Goodfellas. It opened in September of 1990, and it's about the 30th anniversary of the publication of Nick Pileggi's riveting book, Wise Guy, upon which Goodfellas is based. We're delighted to have Nick Pileggi with us tonight. For decades, yeah. Yes, please.
Yeah.
For decades, he has covered the organized crime beat for the AP, New York Magazine, and he's generally considered one of the authoritative journalists covering organized crime, if not really the leading authority on this subject. In a rave review of Wise Guy in the New York Times in 1986, presumably this was the review that caught Martin Scorsese's attention, Vincent Patrick wrote, quote, "Wise Guy evoked for me the quality of the best documentary films. Mr. Pileggi molds Mr. Hill's life story into an absolutely engrossing book that rings with authenticity," unquote. Nick and Martin Scorsese's adaptation of that book into Goodfellas received Academy Award nominations for Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay, among others, and should have won them all, by the way. And did win the British Academy Awards for Picture and Screenplay. In addition to introducing the film and taking some questions afterwards, Nick will be in the lobby signing copies of Wise Guy. Please welcome Nick Pileggi.
Well, I'm going to keep this brief. I just wanted to thank you for being here, getting here on a rainy night, and also thanking this theater, which is one of my favorite theaters. This is my favorite theater. And when they said that this was happening, I was absolutely, I'd love to be down there. So enjoy it, and we'll talk later.
Once again, please welcome Nicholas Pileggi.
Thank you again for being here. I just you don't see it. I haven't seen it in like this, you know, on a real big screen with brand new color. I hadn't seen it in about 20 years.
Really?
Yeah. So it was just an amazing thing for me to see, and thank you.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for coming. Well, maybe a good way to start this off is just to talk a little bit about what happened since this movie was made with Henry Hill. I mean, quite a lot. I mean, after that postscript went up on screen.
Right. Henry, he was, Henry didn't realize being in the Federal Witness Program was, so he was always cutting corners, and he was never really doing the right thing. And I got a call once from him saying, "You got any books?" I said, "Yeah, I got books." He said, "Send me a box of books." I said, "Where? What are you doing? No, send them." And he was in a hotel in Hawaii. And I said, "What are you doing in a hotel in Hawaii?" It turns out he would go to this hotel. He went to this hotel, and he told everybody in the bar who he was. "I'm Henry Hill." I did. And I said, "Are you out of your mind?" "No, no, that's all right. It's okay. It's okay." And he wanted to sign autographs. So I said, "You're in the witness program. Where do you have security?" "Yeah, yeah, I got a guy. It's okay. It's the bomb, and I got a bodyguard right here." I go, "All right." So I had Simon & Schuster send a box of books to this hotel in Hawaii. And then I get a call from the FBI. They say, "Do you send books?" "Yes." He said, what the hell are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean what I'm doing?" "The Justice Department said it's okay. He's got security." They says, "That's no security. Henry met this guy in a bar and said, come to me and watch my back. So he took a bouncer from some bar, and Harry was pretending that guy. So that is the way Henry dealt with the witness program. He was always cutting a corner. He was always looking to itch things. About 5 years ago, he got very sick, and he drugs and pills and drink, and living that kind of a frantic life. And he died about 5 years ago.
I think 3 years ago.
3 years ago?
2012, I think.
Yeah.
That's what I've read. Yeah. And maybe we should talk about your first encounter with him. I mean, he was in the witness protection program when you reached out to you.
Yes, he was. And he was about to start going on trial with these. I got seen with Paulie and Jimmy Burke, because he testified against Jimmy and Paul and everybody. And he had a lawyer that the government approved. Bob Simmels was his name, but he had no way of paying the lawyer. So the only way he could pay the lawyer is if he wrote a book. So his lawyer went around and convinced Simon & Schuster that this guy had an interesting book, a terrific book. And then they interviewed various writers. And I was one of the interviews, because I had been writing about this stuff, the New York Magazine, for years. And when I went in a room, I met Henry. He was sort of interviewing the writers, you see. So I was one of them. And he started talking, and he went, you know, Johnny Wagon Wheels. I was with Johnny Wagon. I said, you mean Fatico? He, oh, you knew Jimmy Fatico? And I said, yes. And so it turned out I knew a lot of the characters he grew up with, which meant it would be easy for him. He would not have to explain a lot.
You knew them by their nicknames.
I knew them by their nicknames. Yeah. I knew their stories. So it turns out that we both knew, because I grew up in Bensonhurst myself, and I knew a lot of those players that he had gone through this experience with. And as a result, he chose me as the writer. Hmm. And it was very, very good for me. I was really lucky. Yeah.
You say so. And Martin Scorsese chose your book.
Yeah. Well, what happened, the book came out, and it was a bestseller. I mean, it was a shock. And I mean, I didn't expect it, because mob books, you know, you don't get there. You can get a lot of readership. But that came out. It was very interesting, because it was about the street-level mobster, and there weren't any books like that. Most of the books were by big shots. Well, you know, Bill Bonanno or Joe Bonanno would write a book. But they were not personal. And you didn't get the wife. I mean, all that stuff. All those jokes, all that stuff that goes on, that's all real. That all happened. And I was lucky enough to have somebody who was a participant, and he was a great talker, and I just took it all down. I got tapes, and so you could kind of go over stuff. And he was very good. As an interviewee, when you talk to somebody, you'll say, what was your first big score? Well, my first big score was $800. I said, what'd you do with the money? Now, most guys, you'd say, what was your first big score? Oh, I don't know, a couple of hundred. How many, you know, you want something. I said, what did you do with the money? Well, I don't know. What the hell? How do you expect me to remember, you know, 20 years ago? Henry Hill, I said, what'd you get for it? He tells me, $800. I said, what'd you do with the money? He said, I bought a yellow 1947 Bonneville convertible. That's gold for a writer, you see? It's a detail. He's coming up, and he just naturally did that. He was a natural storyteller, and he was funny. And so all of that voiceover is really his voice. I mean, it's in the book. I quote him in the book. And that allowed us to really use an authentic voice in the movie. None of that's made up in Hollywood or in Beverly Hills or anything. It was really out of the street and out of him. And Scorsese, in reading the book, heard that voice. And of course, he's heard it all his whole life. Just all you have to do is look at Mean Streets, and you see he knows this was like progress from Mean Streets. Mean Streets was this crew, and this is the same crew, except it's Queens. And Marty loved the book, and then he wanted to do it, and he was shooting The Color of Money with Paul Newman in Chicago, and he called, and I talked to him, and there was a lot of interest in the movie, and there were a lot of directors who were interested in it. But I had known every movie Marty had made. I'd seen The Italian Americans with his mother and father, which is an incredible documentary, and Mean Streets. And I couldn't think of anybody better to do this movie than Scorsese. And he wanted to do it, and he said, let's do it together. And that was the first script I ever wrote. But of course, look at who I'm writing it with, right? So that's the greatest film school in the world. And we had a fabulous time doing it because we knew all these people. We just knew their lifestyle and knew it. And we did it. And then it came out. And we didn't think it was going to work. The first screening they had of it was in Southern California, a place that never even seen an Italian, let alone a mafia. And 71 people walked out. I swear to God, 71 people. And so they start walking out. Marcia says, they're walking out. I said, no, Marcia. They're going to the bathroom. They're coming back, he said. And they did. We had 71 walkouts. Yes. And as a result, Warner Brothers worried about the movie and canned it. We were supposed to open up in like 1,000 theaters, and they knocked us down to 450, which means your opening weekend is a bomb. And that's exactly what happened with the movie. The movie they decided was going to be the Warner Brothers Bafo movie, because of its credits and stuff, was The Bonfire of the Vanities. So they took all of our theaters and gave them to the Bonfire. But then the reviews came out, and the reviews were sensational. I mean, every one of them was just amazing. And then they had to re-gear, but it was too late to get the movie in theaters again. So it's never made money.
The reviews were fantastic, and I think Siskel and Ebert reviewed it twice. They were so enthusiastic.
It was an amazing period.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to get to the audience and take your questions. Tim has a microphone. We'll pass it around. This one right here. Yep. Second off the aisle.
Hi. I was just curious about how you got permission in the witness protection program. You're allowed to write a book about your crimes. I guess sort of surprised by that, and wondering, did the DOJ like clear your manuscript or anything like that?
No, you can't do it. You can't, if you follow the rules, you're never going to get anything done. So what happens? What happens is the first time you meet Henry Hill, the FBI, the marshals are all over. You can't. They wouldn't give me the ticket until they said, we can't give you the ticket. Go to the bathroom. You have to go to the bathroom? No. So here it is, because you can't go to the bathroom.
When you're first flying to meet him, right?
So you fly, and then you land someplace, and then you're met, and you go on a second plane. They want to make sure so that when you land, you then drive to a motel where you meet Henry Hill. That was the first thing. It was good. I mean, there's no way to do a book. You can't do a book that way. So in no time at all, I knew the kind of character Henry was anyway. So he slipped me his secret number, him my secret number, and we both went back, and then we started to communicate quite often without the marshals. And I would he was in a witness program in Kentucky for a while, and he had a tourist trolley operation going. I mean, insane jobs. and then he was in Redmond, Washington for a while, the bicycle capital of the world, before it became the home of Microsoft. I mean, this is before the computer boom. But he lived there for a while. And I mean, one time I met him in Vancouver. He would just take off. And I met him there. And he said, let's, and he meets me at the airport. And he's there with a couple of girls. I mean, I don't have anything to do with girls. So he comes, he says, come on, we're going. So we wanted to, he said, let's get a bite to eat. So it's on this road, like on the side of a cliff, side of a mountain. And so we stopped in one of these inns. We go in the inn, and I just gotten off the plane. So I'm going to go to the men's room. He says, yeah, go ahead. We got a table right here. So I'm coming out, and he says, come on. I'm looking, and the maitre d' has blood coming down the front of his forehead. And apparently the guy wised off to Henry, and Henry hit him in the head with a bottle. So now Henry says, come on, we got to get out of here. Now I'm with Henry Hill, these two broads nobody knows. And I'm in a car, and Henry says, come on. So we get in the car, and all of a sudden, I'm speeding away. I mean, what cops are going to come? These places are all connected, you know? So you get to the police. And, you know, I can see myself in some kind of Humphrey Bogart movie. But anyway, we got away. There was no problem. But but what that allowed me to do was have a relationship with him outside of the feds and outside of all that nonsense. And that's the only way it could have worked. And I interviewed him it took about 2 years, 2.5 years, just talking to him.
This is in the early 80s, I assume. Yes.
The use of voiceover in the movie must be completely unprecedented in the history of cinema, I think. I'm not sure about that, but there's so much of it. and it's so expressive and compelling. Yeah. It's sort of a driving force through the film. And I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about when you decided to embrace that, as you know, with Scorsese in the writing process, and how that might have evolved.
The thing that Marty liked about the book was that so much of it was in Henry Hill's voice, and just add over to it, and it's the voiceover. So how do we take that voice from the book and put it in the movie? And of course, just make it voiceover. Let him tell his own story. Now, that's been used many, many times in movies. What often it's used for is if you have a complicated plot and you haven't figured out the plot, you then have a voiceover explaining it to people. That isn't what we have here. What we have here is really the essence of the story in the movie is really in that voiceover. It's Henry Hill telling the story. And as we started doing it, we said, why stop with Henry? Karen should have a voice too. And that's what we did. We followed the same pattern, by the way, with a Casino. Because if you have a book, and I don't mean my book, it'd be any book, if you have a book where you have the voice of your major character just talking in his own language, in his own phraseology, that's invaluable in a movie, to get that kind of authenticity in it. And and so that's why we used it, and it works very well. I think the most unique thing, one of the most unique things in the movie is the Steadicam of going into the Copacabana. That's just pure Marty, because if you read the script and you read in my book, it's like three sentences. I mean, that's what an idiot I am. I missed it. No. He knew exactly what to do with that, you know, and the right music. That's another thing I heard tonight for the first time, because he said, we got all these characters, but he said, music is a character. He always said that music in this movie is a character, and he's absolutely right. I was listening to it again, you know, not on a TV set, so it's still great.
Yeah. More questions? Yes, on the aisle right there.
I'd like to ask a question about the Billy Batts murder.
Yeah.
In the movie, the idea that comes across is that it's just the result of this animosity between Billy Batts and the Joe Pesci character. But from what I've read, there was something else going on, I think. And if I understood it correctly, when Batts went to prison, he had to turn his loan sharking operation over to Burke, who I guess played as Jimmy Conway in the movie.
Yeah, Conway.
And then when Batts came out of prison, he wanted his loan shark business back. Burke didn't want to give it back to him and decided to kill him to keep it. And that isn't touched on in the movie, but is it possible that the animosity and the conflict between Burke and Billy Batts was all mixed up together, and that maybe that Conway was manipulating the whole thing so that it would come out that way.
You know, that could very well be true, by the way. But in doing a movie, that would have taken us out. You know, now you got to start with Billy Batts how do we deal with the loan shark operation that he really was a part of? Jimmy, even though he went away for 6 years, you know, it complicated it. There's a lot of stuff that's left out. That's in the book, that's left out of the movie. But you just have to do it. You just have to slice things off sometimes and just hang on to the central thing you're trying to do. Well, that's very serious. Are you a cop?
No,
I was curious, because that's not well known, is what I'm saying.
That should be the first question people in the audience, right? Yes, on the aisle, right here.
Did you interview anyone other than Henry Hill for the book, any of the characters specifically?
Well, unfortunately, Paul Vario, Cicero character, was already, he was away. There was no way to reach him, and he was not going to talk to a reporter. I almost got to him. He went to school, grammar school, with a major political Democratic Party figure in Brooklyn, who I knew from covering reporting. And that political figure talked to him and said, just talk to the guy. You got nothing to, you know, it's the, and I was supposed to meet Vario in a McDonald's in Brooklyn somewhere. And then I got the call. Says, nah, he's changed his mind. He's not going to do it. I talked to Jimmy, the Conway character's wife, and his daughter, spent time with them, went to, they asked me whether I would do them the favor of going to the court and sitting with him, with Jimmy's wife and daughter in the court when Henry testified. I was hoping that that would get me a shot of going up to see Jimmy when he's away. And and they wanted me there just to bust Henry's chops. There is the guy who wrote your book sitting with Jimmy and his family. But Henry already knew that. I told Henry what I was doing, so it was okay. But so you get to know, and you get another side of it. There are a few other people who are, not directly involved in the movie, but directly involved with all of these guys.
More questions. Here in the middle, you? Yep. One row back, yep.
Getting to know Henry Hill, was there a defining characteristic about the real man that separates him from the character we know so well, played by Ray Liotta?
You know, that the Ray was an interesting... Henry Hill, if you look at some early pictures of him, met him, he was a good-looking guy. I mean, he was sort of slick, but really... And a great laugh and a great smile and funny and very charming. But incredibly energized. He didn't need sleep. He's just very hyper. And that's why he's always into things. He's always doing this. That the end of the movie, when he's on coke, of course, where he sees the helicopters and he's got to make the tomato sauce. And that is absolutely verbatim. That's exactly what his last day was like. And I had him go through it very slowly. But he was a very, a really charming guy, except he had a amoral view of life.
Right. I think there's a question right here.
Hi, thank you. Really quickly, did you ever get to speak to Karen, and what was your sense of her? And while you were talking to, thank you, my God, Henry, was, given the sensitive nature of everything, did you ever, was your life ever in danger? Did you ever need some sort of protection?
No, not at all. I mean, because all of it's gone. You see, he's already testified. Everybody's in jail. I mean, I'm not exposing anything. I'm not an investigative reporter that can threaten them in any way. I'm really the recorder of history. And in an odd way, a lot of the participants read the book and were fascinated by it. Huh. I mean, fascinated by getting a look at that lifestyle. And this is people in that life. But if you're in that life and in the Bronx with a different family, you're fascinated what's going on, because they don't have a newspaper. You know, they can't communicate as easily as a lot of other people. So it was fascinating to a lot of those guys. Karen, I spent a lot of time with, not as much as with Henry, but a lot. And she was really, it's interesting. She went from, a very middle-class person to a mall, in a sense, and then pulled out and divorced him 25 years after marriage, and then lived an entirely different life.
Towards the back, yes. You're going.
Yeah.
90s. How did that come about?
That's Marty. That's Scorsese. He really is very knowledgeable about all of that music, and he knew it when we were writing the script. Yeah. You see that scene when Maury is just busting his chops, and then Maury comes out of the back after singing Danny Boy, and Jimmy is sitting at the bar smoking a cigarette. And as I was we were writing the script at that point, he said, put in Cream, Cream. I said, what's Cream? Just put in Cream, Cream. Because I'm not that current with me. I just don't, I'm sort of a Tony Bennett Sinatra guy. I mean, this. And so I put it in the script. And of course, he knew that piece of music, the Sunshine of Your...
Sunshine of Your Love.
Yeah, yeah. That's the piece. He knew what it was. He knew that's what he wanted right there in that scene. But to do that, when you're writing your first draft of a script, you can see the kind of how he envisions the movie, even when it's that early in its writing.
And the songs that he chooses during the cocaine sequence is
every
incredible.
Song is, and he told me, in fact, that I mentioned it to you, he said that music is one of the characters. And he knew this music. He had been listening to it all his life, and he knew exactly what was appropriate for this period of time.
Yeah. Yes, in the corner, on the aisle again, in blue shirt.
Two quick questions. One is, how do you think Henry actually lived a full life and didn't somehow get whacked by some mobster hero guy? Yeah. Didn't want to. Yeah. And the other question is, do you have any connection with The Sopranos? I mean, there's so many overlap. There's so many characters, 7 or 8 actors that did that too.
Yeah,
did they ever appeal to you to help with that?
David Chase says that. I know him, and he's been very generous. And the characters are. When we started to cast the movie, Marty did not want, nor did I, want actors, you know, ex-Calvin Klein models, acting like gangsters with hats that are 2 sizes too big and double-breasted overcoats. I mean, that's, we've seen too many of those, and unfortunately, I think we're seeing a lot of it now on AMC. But aside from that, he wanted authentic characters. So I knew a lot of people, and I said, all right, we'll go to this restaurant I know, and we'll cast it out of the restaurant. So Marty and I put the word out, we need guys, real guys. So Marty and I and Ellen Lewis, the casting director, went to this restaurant. We're sitting there, knew the owners and everything. And all of a sudden, these guys say, hey, how are you? Whatever. And so they started coming in, and Marty said, him. This. And so that's where we cast the damn movie, believe it or not. A lot of those people. When you go around the room and you see all of those guys, this is Johnny Two Times. Half of those guys are street guys. One of them, that big heavy guy, that's Louis Eppolito. Detective Louis Eppolito, who's a hitman for the Brooklyn mob, killed about 6 people. And that he's one of the guys. His Petey Neck is there, who walks around like this. These were guys, so when Warner Brothers had to pay them, Warner Brothers says, oh, get their social security numbers. You're sure, they'll give you a say. They got a social security number. So they didn't have, so, and they wanted cash. I'm going to be in a movie, I want cash. So we explained to Warner Brothers that no, you had to pay them in cash, do it out of petty cash, however the hell you do it. These guys don't have social security numbers. And a couple of them gave social security numbers, but they gave too many numerals. So, I mean, these poor Warner Brothers people were totally flummoxed by it. But Marty was right. There is an authenticity in those characters. And Michael Paraleone, Michael Imperiale is, of course, Skippy, yeah, who gets hit and shot in the foot.
Spider.
And it's another character.
Where did you find Maury?
Maury is Bob De Niro's landlord. True. Maury owned this building on Hudson Street, across the street from Nobu, where Bob lived at the time. And Maury, I want to be in the movies, just the way he is here. He wanted to be in the movie. Bob put him in the movie, and he was brilliant.
Yeah, perfect.
And Maury's wife, who comes running and screaming, I know he's dead. That's Irwin Winkler's wife, Margot Winkler. And the picture of the dogs, you know, one dog looking one way, one dog looking the other, and the guy looked like Billy Batts at the oars, that was painted by my mother. And she, yeah, I'm telling you, that she was like 88, 89 at the time, and she had, you know, gone into paintings. And where did you find that? She found that in the National Geographic. She would go through the Geographic and cut out pictures and paint them. So she painted that one, and we thought that'd be perfect for the movie because it looked just like Billy Batts. So Frank Vincent, who has never had a beard in the movie, had to now wear a beard to make himself look like my mother's painting, because we're going to use my mother's painting. And I didn't see it tonight, but she got the last credit in the movie. You all the credits, it says painting by Susan Pileggi. And she referred to it ever since. From then on, she said, did you see my movie? See my movie? Yeah, well. I think Marty's mother, of course, and father are in the movie. It was that kind of a thing. And, you know, we just bunch of Italian kids, I guess.
Just a couple more questions, maybe in back. Yep. And just wait for the mic.
Hi. I think maybe I was always aware of it, but not until seeing it with so many people did the movie register as being really funny. Like, these really violent robbers and killers.
I made you laugh?
Everyone was laughing so much. I was actually a little bit perturbed at the start, and I was like, oh my God, they're these awful people, and everyone's laughing. But then it's, you know, you kind of fall into it, and you're laughing too. Were you ever uncomfortable with how funny the movie was turning out to be?
Never, because those guys are funny. I mean, they're funny. You know, when they're burying you, they're funny. I mean, they're digging up the body. I couldn't make that up. I mean, that's Henry talking about when we had to dig the body up. Tommy was driving me crazy. He was mentioning lungs and hearts, and but I'm puking on the side. And Jimmy, it's part of that business about am I funny? I didn't write that. That was done by Joe Pesci, and he had seen it in a mob club. He'd been invited. He was there with a bunch of guys, and he saw one wise guy do it to another wise guy. And in that scene, Joe went to Marty and said, I got an idea. Let me do this thing I saw. So he explained it to Marty. And the first time they shot it, Marty did not tell the other guys. So when Joe starts going in, there is that first, you'll see it. It's like, wait a minute, he's off script. What's going on? And it really captures something in that moment. Then, of course, they had to do it over and lots of times like you do in a movie. But it was brilliant. And it was Joe Patch, all ad-lib by Joe. I mean, that whole thing. I've been complimented for it so many times, but I keep giving the credit back to Joe because it really is going. But that's also part of Scorsese. He's very improvisational. I mean, he's got people he trusts, like De Niro and Pesci and Frank Vincent. He'll let the give it a shot. Try it. And, you know, it's only film. And if it doesn't work, we don't use it.
Last question. Yes, right here.
I just have a question sort of journalistically. Henry Hill is presented often typically as a bystander to the most extreme or irrational violence. And I'm wondering if that's because he presented it to you that way when he told the stories, but obviously it's in his interest to do so, and it's hard to fact check for reasons you already discussed. So I was wondering if you ever asked yourself, is he presenting these facts in a way, and am I repeating it in a way that is totally accurate?
Yeah. Yes, this is who he was. I got that not from him. Of course I got it from him. But I got it from Ed McDonald. I got it from all the FBI agents who were on him for months, guys who knew him, local cops who had seen him on the street. He was not a violent guy. That didn't mean he wouldn't kick Billy Batts and bury a body and do that kind of stuff. He'd do all of that. And he'll punch a guy and try to get the money out of him in Florida. That's all true. And it was an FBI secretary who actually, whose brother they beat up. I mean, it's insane. But he was not, and he wasn't a made guy. He was a hustler. He earned money for them. They loved him for that. He was that guy, and he was loyal. He would never rat anybody out. He did the right thing by everybody. But he was not one of the bad guys. In other words, you couldn't do this book with Tommy DeSimone, with the Joe Pesci character, because he's truly violent, crazy, and or any of those other guys. But Henry was the key. He was like the soldier in Napoleon's army. He saw it all, and he could tell you with great clarity what was going on. And the cops felt the same way about him. I mean, the detective, the organized crime strike force, who had really been on him and knew everything he had done. They just got it all. And I felt no compunctions at all about making him the central character here.
Well, it's a magnificent achievement. It holds up beautifully. And I want to thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.